This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we visit with an extremely accomplished British musician who holds an esteemed position here in the U.S. at not only one of the most prestigious churches, but one of the only churches remaining with a choir school attached, St. Thomas on Fifth Avenue in New York City. My guest, Daniel Hyde, is starting his second full season as director of music and organist at St. Thomas. You're listening to him lead his choir in music of Anton Bruckner, the motet Christus Factus Est. Raised as a chorister at Durham Cathedral, my guest was made a fellow at the Royal College of Organists at age 17 and won a scholarship to King's College, Cambridge. During his time at King's, he served under Dr. Stephen Cleobury. After graduation, he was appointed director of music at Jesus College, Cambridge, and then served as director at Magdalen College. Upon the untimely death of John Scott on this side at St. Thomas, my guest was chosen to lead this distinguished choir with a long, esteemed history. I spoke with Daniel Hyde in a basement choral music library at St. Thomas up in New York City last week.
Here today with Daniel Hyde, who is the organist and director of music at St. Thomas. This is your second full season.
Yep.
So I thought we'd start off right away. The difference, the feeling you have starting your second season from where you were last year at this time.
Well, this time last year, I was only 4 weeks, well, maybe a little bit longer, 5 or 6 weeks into living in America. I'd arrived in August, started here in September. Of course, starting the second season, you know where the little things are going to be lurking. You know where the, not so much pitfalls, but you know where the pressure points are. So I feel a lot more comfortable knowing what's probably around the corner as we build up to Christmas, right?
So right.
That's our big push now.
So last year was, not surprises, but oh, this is how it's done. I think this is where it's at.
Yeah, last year was always a sense of being on edge.
Yeah.
Just being aware that there could be something that I didn't know needs to happen or needs to be done. But then I've got very good colleagues here who were brilliant at just alerting me to things which would be coming up that I wouldn't know about. Just sort of St. Thomas-shaped things. Special services or stuff to do with the choir schedule versus the chorister's schooling, because of course the terms here are slightly different. Thanksgiving holiday, end of one term, I mean, all these sorts of things, just letting me know the rhythm of the place. So they were very helpful.
Now, you were appointed after a brief search to, you succeeded John Scott, who was here from 2004 till his death in 15. You're the 22nd person to hold this position. So give us, from what you've gleaned here, a little background of this place, as musically speaking, as far as you know.
I suppose I've known about this place for many years because it's the only choral foundation of its type here in America.
Right.
Some people always say to me, oh, you've got Little England at St. Thomas, so it must be home from home. And of course, it's not, because it's a sort of an American-shaped Anglican choral tradition. And I think that's one of its unique selling points, which is brilliant. It's one of the things that attracted me to come here. But I've known about St. Thomas since I was, in fact, a chorister in Durham in the 80s, back in England, because we did some performances of the Lloyd Webber Requiem, which had actually been premiered here in the church. And I remember seeing in the inside cover of the score, business about St. Thomas Fifth Avenue, and in fact, my choir director in Durham was previously the assistant organist at Winchester Cathedral, and it was Winchester Cathedral Choir that came out here and did this. So I've known about St. Thomas since I was a child. And then, of course, you know, as I got a little bit older, I met people along the way who had connections here. And actually, there was a former St. Thomas chorister who was a priest in Australia when I worked in Perth, between school and university, and he was the chaplain to the Archbishop, and he was a chorister here, and he, I remember, used to play me all sorts of recordings of Jerry Hancock with the choir of St. Thomas. So I became aware of them then as an actual performing group rather than just a name in a place.
How far back does the esteemed nature of St. Thomas's choir, how far back does that go, where it really was something quite special, do you know?
Well, I think it goes all the way back to the time when the choir school was formed, 1919.
Yeah.
3rd of March, they opened their doors, and we have the same setup to this day. And I think because that was unique and it was based on a tried and tested English model, it has been well known since that time. I mean, in the early days, the choir used to go and sing for Toscanini at NBC and Bruno Walter at Carnegie Hall, you know, very soon after the choir was formed in its current shape. And it's continued to do that ever since.
Thank you.
So, as people just heard, this is not such a ridiculous leap for you to come here. Durham Cathedral, then King's College, Cambridge, Magdalen College, Oxford. So give us a thumbnail resume of, you're pretty steeped in this and you've had a pretty impressive career. So give us a little bit of your timeline.
I've kind of been marinated in Oxford and Cambridge. as you say, I was a boy at Durham, and one of the things I always point out to people who are thinking about choristership is that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now had I not been a boy chorister, because the musical experience and the tuition and so on I had in Durham, it was exactly as we give here. We were required to be professionals at that young age, and we were doing things, as our boys here do, which some students, you know, in their early 20s might be still working towards doing. So that early professional basis stood me in good stead to get a scholarship to my secondary school. I wouldn't have been able to go there otherwise because the fees were too high. Right. So then I benefited from all that experience in my teenage years, which got me a scholarship to go to Cambridge. So everything reads back to having been a chorister, which I think is one of the great values of what we offer here now. It is a life-changing experience. So once I'd got that scholarship, I went to Australia for 2 years before going up to King's Cambridge. I'd always wanted to go to King's since I was 12. My mother took us to Cambridge one day, and I walked into the chapel, and I remember seeing it and thinking, wow, this will be amazing, because, of course, I'd been a chorister by that stage. And she just turned around to me and said, well, you'll have to work very hard. So I did, and I had 3 amazing years there. And King's is very much my sort of home. Cambridge is very much the place in England which I would think of as home. And 3 years at King's taught me all sorts of things to do with choirs and organs. And of course, we're very fortunate to go on tours all over the world and to have this extraordinary experience. And then I thought that I might stick around in Cambridge whilst not being the organist at King's, just to see whether other things happened, you know, not practicing the organ late into the night, not playing 6 services a week in chapel and so on. And it was during that 4th year that an opportunity came up at another Cambridge college, Jesus College, which is where Thomas Cranmer, author of the Book of Common Prayer, various other, you know, influential historical figures had all been students. And Jesus has a different kind of choral setup, boys drawn from all over the town rather than from all over the UK. And I ran the choir there for 5 years. Wasn't expecting to do that. And then I went to Oxford. And of course, as a Cambridge man going to Oxford, that's a big pill to swallow, because there's a great rivalry between the two universities. But I felt, you know, the St. Thomas opportunity, as you said, it came about because of John's untimely death. And I think, you know, it wasn't expected. I think you end up doing the things you least expect to do in life. And I figured when I was offered this job that I'm probably only ever going to be offered it once.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you were at Magdalen College at Oxford, and then you're primed to just have this incredible English career. And then this comes. Phone call? How did this come about?
I think St. Thomas had people sort of ferreting about, sniffing out certain candidates, that sort of thing. I was certainly aware of things, but there was a job description on the St. Thomas website. I had a little look at it and I thought, well, it could be fun. I actually came to New York kind of under the radar for a weekend, which is a bit of a long way to come for the weekend. But nobody knew I was here until I got spotted by somebody, apparently. But I just had a little look around and I thought, you know, you've got to embrace opportunities if they come along. So I was willing to put my hat in and see what happened. And here we are now.
And they just came back to you after?
Well, I think there was a process of a number of people.
Right, sure. Were you surprised?
I was flattered. I was surprised in the sense that, I mean, what I do is I just sort of get up and do what I do. And I was flattered in the sense they seemed to like that. I was surprised, of course, you only worry about a job when you're offered it. So when I was offered it, I then had to really sort of think about it. But it's been a great experience thus far.
My guest, Daniel Hyde, follows in a distinguished line of music directors at St. Thomas Fifth Avenue. Here are 2 selections with the choir singing under the direction of 2 of his predecessors. First, the hymn Abide With Me, composed by William Monk, with a descant by Jerry Hancock, and is he who leads, and was at that time music director, of the St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys. And then, my guest's immediate predecessor, John Scott, leads the choir in John Taverner's The Lamb. Thank you.
The St. Thomas Choir Men and Boys is not only one of the esteemed choirs connected with a church here in the U.S., but it is unique and singular in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could point those out, let's start with the boys, the trebles. Just what is special and really one of its last of its kind type of thing here at St. Thomas?
So the trebles are from grades 3 to 8. So they audition around the age of 7, something like that. They join us at 7 or 8, and they go all the way through to 12, 13. So it's a crucial time in the boys' life because, of course, their treble voice will peak and then it will begin to change. So one of our USPs, if you like, is the fact that we only have boys singing the top line, and that generates its own very specific sound. There are many other choirs where there's perhaps a mixed top line of boys and girls, and of course a girl's voice isn't going to start to really bloom and then change around 12, 13. It's going to just carry on, and by having those two combinations of kids you get a different sound. So what the sound at St. Thomas is very unique to the fact that it is all male. That's to say, that's a choice based on the sort of sound we want, not to say that I'm against girls singing. In fact, in my previous two jobs, I have worked with girls and boys and actually set up more opportunities for girls to sing, because I think that is a long overdue thing, that the church needs to offer more opportunities for girls to get involved. But of course, there is this amazing tradition that so many boys who've sung at St. Thomas then go on to be adult singers. So there is also that sort of feeding of the tradition, and that's certainly the way it's been in the UK. I think the other unique thing about St. Thomas is that we have our choir school attached, and it is specifically for the boys who sing. So we would have up to about 30 boys in the school, and we're full. At the moment, we're on 24. And, you know, one of our challenges is recruitment, because I think times have changed. Certainly in the 30 years since I was a treble, it's not so fashionable to send your child away to boarding school. And I think in America, even less so than it is in the UK. So that is something that we have to think about. We have to, you know, look at ways of recruiting more locally. We have to consider, you know, whether there are things we should do to make it easier for children to come here. But once they get a musical place, so if I assess a boy and he's vocally up for it, there's no barrier to coming to the school. So we find bursaries and scholarships. So there's no financial barrier to a boy coming here. And of course, the school is extremely academic, small class sizes, boys all going on in the eighth grade to serious places at high school. So, I mean, those are our sort of unique characteristics, that we can offer an education at vastly reduced rate because we have bursaries. And we offer this bespoke music program as well.
So those kids, those boys are accepted, go to school here. This is their academic training and their music training. So music is, what, 2 or 3 hours a day or so? Or something,
Something like that, yeah. We rehearse Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We rehearse in the morning before school for an hour and a quarter. And then after school, the boys come over to church and we rehearse with the gentlemen of the choir as well. And then we sing a service.
So once they're in high school and then going into the men who make up the choir, where do they come from? Is it strictly by audition? Is it carryover?
Well, so the trebles graduate and they leave and they go off. We have professional altos, tenors and basses drawn from the New York singing circuit, really. Right. So it's a pretty good gig for an alto, tenor or bass, pretty regular work. And the timings are such that our gents are able to sing in all sorts of other groups in town. So as a freelance singer, it's a good part of the portfolio.
You keep them busy. I mean, like 200 performances, something like that a year, if you take any?
Something like that. I mean, the season runs September through to June. And in a normal week, we have 5 services. So if you like performances, 5 times where we are actually in public in church. But then, obviously, December gets a little bit busier. We have concerts. We've got concerts coming up throughout the season in our own series. And then at Easter, the week leading up to Easter, I think there's something like 21 services or something crazy. But that's the best music of all. All the liturgical music for Easter, of course, is just wonderfully colourful and beautiful.
Yeah, so just to lay out the season here in your second year, you do have obligatory things. There is a Messiah.
Yeah, we do 2 Messiahs in December. That I think we're known to go first in the Messiah season. You know, that's how it works.
Get that number one. And then you have concerts throughout the year.
So we have an October concert. Orchestra St. Luke's often join us for that. Then we have the Messiahs, and the boys do a Christmas concert incorporating Britain's Ceremony of Carols. That's become a tradition.
Right.
And then there's usually something more passion tied related in February, March. So last season we did C.P.E. Bach's St. John Passion. So not quite his father's, but a slightly smaller scale passion. And this year we're actually doing the Brahms Requiem, which of course is not a passion, but it's a sort of requiem for people who are still living. It's a kind of human requiem. That's how he envisaged it. It's not the normal requiem text. So we're doing that in March with two pianos, which is, again, an arrangement Brahms made of his own orchestral score. And then in May, we'll do a cantatas concert with some Bach and Vivaldi just before Ascension. So there's a mixture of early music and a mixture of more modern and contemporary as well as 19th century stuff.
And you're able to bring in guest artists. You're bringing in one of the most esteemed choir directors there is. Stephen Darlington's coming in.
We normally have a visiting choir in our season.
Okay. And you've got some great connections there, I would assume.
Well, I know Stephen very well from my Oxford days, but also my assistant here, Ben Sheen, he was a student of Stephen when Ben was at Oxford. So there are little connections. And I think the following year we've got Kings coming. We're trying to firm that up at the moment, but they will be here on tour in 2019, so they will be our visiting choir. We like to welcome friends, put it that way.
The Nunc Dimittis here by Charles Wood, recorded, like the howls we heard earlier, at a choral evensong just last month at St. Thomas on Fifth Avenue in New York City. The St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys is led by their music director and my guest today, Daniel Hyde.
So as far as what you do perform, how much, well, you're probably still figuring this out in your second year, but how much leeway are you given from the traditions that are St. Thomas as far as programming and music you want to explore? I mean, where are those lines where you know, this is what I have to present, this is where I'd like to go, things like that.
Well, the things that I have to present, I try and choose a varied core repertoire as a way of teaching the boys, right. So they learn their skills through that core repertoire. Extra things to that that I would like to develop further or indeed investigate would be, of course, American music. There's quite a lot of St. Thomas music from my predecessors. There is music which has been commissioned by St. Thomas over the years, which is probably somewhere in this room. And then there's also the business of commissioning new music.
Right.
We've got a partnership with a journal, choir and organ next year, which involves a feature every 2 months on St. Thomas, but also a new composition that's being commissioned for each feature. So just providing an opportunity for composers under 30 who are making their way in the world to write something which they'll get a very good first performance. It'll be webcast. It could be recorded.
Yeah, how are those composers chosen?
That's an ongoing discussion with the editor of this particular journal. So we approach Juilliard and Curtis and conservatoires with good composing faculties and see who's around. And actually also just looking and seeing whose music is being premiered at the moment, who are the people around. I mean, I really feel for these guys that if you're a composer in this day and age, you've got to be first and foremost your own market coordinator.
Yeah, your own cottage industry.
I think the composing comes way down the list of priorities in some senses, because you've got to promote yourself all the time. So what we can do using our name and the fact that we're here in the middle of New York is maybe just help a few of these guys along the way, and hopefully, you know, we'll get some nice little additions to the repertoire.
There are, well, I would make the assumption there are pieces in your head that you don't have to name them, but the pieces as you go here that you're going to want to, or composers that you want to perform with this choir, and you'll be able to go down those paths and bring those pieces into their repertoire.
Yeah, there's a lot of concert repertoire that I would like to investigate further, especially the sort of German cantata repertory. And in terms of specific service music, there is a lot of polyphony, 16th century stuff, which I think has not always been top of the list here. I'd like to inject a little bit of that, but I'd also like to inject a lot more sort of indigenous American music, because as I said earlier, people say, oh, this is like Little England, you know. I don't want to bring everything from England. We're not trying to do that. St. Thomas has got to be St. Thomas shaped. So I think there's probably quite a lot of music lounging in the library where, you know, it needs dusting off, and we need to have a bit of quality control and pick out the things which are good.
Yeah.
And we should be promoting that. We should be promoting American music.
Yeah, you should be.
The St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys here singing some American music, once again led by my guest's predecessor, John Scott. This is Randall Thompson's Alleluia.
you have a well, this is sort of meat and potatoes for so many choir directors, but you have this dual track of choir director organist.
Yeah.
And you were quite accomplished, or you are quite accomplished as an organist. I mean, So you mentioned the name Ben Sheen. He's here to our listeners who have really fantastic memories. Might remember that we worked closely with Longwood Gardens for their first biannual organ competition years ago and interviewed all the judges, Paul Jacobs and all the rest, Peter Conti. And then he was the winner of that initial one. So he landed here. Fellow Brit. Is it difficult to keep your organ chops, your organ career, where you want it? Because you had it at a pretty high level. So I'm just wondering how you keep those two going. It's not like the parish church where you're playing a few hymns and you do the choir and you go home. You want to keep it at the high level you had.
Since coming here, I've purposefully, deliberately allowed it to sit slightly because, of course, I've had enough to do getting my head around a new start and so on. I would like to do more playing. I'm the sort of person who does not react well to being on tour for 3 weeks by myself. So there is a problem if you're an organist. And I used to do quite a bit of that. And I suppose I've done less of that. I'm quite keen to nail my musical colours, you know, firmly to the St. Thomas mast. And to, if you like, take the St. Thomas brand out and about when I go off and do concerts. So far as finding time to keep my playing chops going, that is always, you know, a constant struggle. I've got to the stage now where I actually have to put physically time aside in my diary and just go and do it and not have a phone with me or not be thinking about the email that just came in that really needs an answer now because, you know, you've got everything coming at you now. And with all this technology we all have, you've got it coming from so many different directions.
Right.
And that is the thing that gets in the way when you're trying to be creative. I mean, learning scores to conduct is another thing. They just have to carve time for that. It has to be a priority. Because the last thing I want to do is stand up in a concert or sit at the organ in a concert and think, oh, why am I playing this piece, you know?
But can you insert yourself, even on a given service Sunday, just as organist, just to keep the
I usually play on a Sunday morning at the end of the service.
All right.
And I recently played a recital in the church for the early music festival. And just having things like that in the diary, it means that I do carve out that time and I get up and do it. And also just time to learn new music.
Yeah.
My guest's organ talent and interest in early music came together in a recording he made with the wonderful viol concert Phantasm of music by 17th century English composer William Laws. Here from the set in G minor, we'll hear the opening Fantasy. Listen closely through the viols to hear the subtle playing of my guest Daniel Hyde on organ. Thank you.
last thing here, because that's kind of an interesting other facet to your career, and it's not true of all music director, choir directors, is you've always aligned yourself or been connected with a lot of the early music scene. You've performed with a number of early music groups, high profile music groups, and where does that stem from, just that interest in music of centuries past? And not choral music necessarily.
No, I think I've always had before I went to university, I actually was thinking of applying to Cambridge to read history and not music. I would have applied for the organ scholarship at King's, so as a practical musician, but reading for history as the subject. I've always been interested in what's gone on before, and I suppose there's an early music, historically informed performance angle to my view of history. Right. And music as a cultural product, and music and ceremony, the idea that actually music was something, it was a tool, and it was something which could be used for good and bad. So I've always had that sort of historically inquiring mind. So that fits quite well with historically informed performance. But when I was at Cambridge, there was so much of that going on. And I used to say that, you know, if you wanted to find someone to play tiddlywinks with at Cambridge, you'd find them. Or if you wanted to organise a performance of Boulez or Thomas Adès' latest opera, you know, you'd find people to do it with you. And it's absolutely true. I put on all sorts of things in Cambridge. I would never want to hear them recorded now because they were probably absolutely terrible. But it was an opportunity when lots of people were cutting their teeth. Lots of my good friends from Cambridge are now, you know, international professional musicians, right, big stars. And we were all just there kind of discovering at that time. And I did a lot of keyboard playing. Tended to get asked to play harpsichord and organ for all these sort of shows. And then when I graduated, I needed to make some money. And I used to go to London a lot. And I was very lucky to just be asked, you know, a friend of mine couldn't do a gig, so I would be asked if I could do that gig. And then you get on the books for these different ensembles and the whole thing takes off. But when I was at Oxford, I had an amazing colleague, Lawrence Dreyfus, the viol player. He and I were the two fellows in music at Magdalen. And it was just an amazing opportunity to work with viols. And he brought the viols Phantasm to record and perform with the choir. We did a number of discs of early English stuff. But then he really wanted to record William Law's consort music, which exists for up to six viols without any keyboard. But there is also an organ part. And so he wanted to do it in this particular version. And we recorded that music. And disc did extremely well, and we played lots of concerts of chamber music. It was just wonderful. Rather than being a solo organist sitting up in my gallery all lonely and, you know, nobody else to play with.
Playing with other musicians. What a concept.
What a revelation, right?
Well, that's great. It's great that those years are so fruitful, you know.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Well, best of success here. Hope you have a lot of years ahead of you here at this very esteemed institution. It really is. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat with someone from the past, I mean, never had a chance to, but could. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? You can get swamped if you think about it.
William.
William.
Bird.
Yeah, one of the more fascinating figures.
Well, it's my historical bent coming on, you know, the fact that he was this recusant Catholic.
Yeah.
Living
two lives, really.
Living two lives, surviving as well.
It's interesting, you know, you're the first person in 13 years to pick Bird, but that's okay, because it'd be interesting how forthcoming he was among friends. I don't know if there's any documentation of that. You know?
I think he was quite political, actually. I think he was very much an objector. I think he would have been quite an interesting guy to sit and have a drink with, because there's all these political undertones in his music as well.
Right.
And choice of texts, certain ways in which they're set. The fact that he was openly breaking the law. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that. But I sort of aspire to do that. But I can't do that here, otherwise I get chucked out of the country and lose my visa. But
yeah, especially these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watch your step on that. Final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy with this position you have. But when you have to get away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but need a respite, what do you do? Pull yourself away if you have the time during the week.
It's relatively recent that I've learned to pull myself away from something which is kind of like a vocation. I mean, I read a lot, I cook a lot, I travel quite a bit.
Yeah.
I'm the sort of person who decides I've got 2 weeks and I don't book anything until I need it. I sometimes stand outside hotels and book the hotel whilst stealing their Wi-Fi, obviously, yeah, and then I go in and take my room. Or I book a flight on the way to the airport, you know, or I turn up to the airport and see what's available and decide where to go. That's my way of switching off.
Okay.
But I read a lot. I find it very difficult during term that I don't read, and I know when I'm getting tired, I have to just fill my head with something else.
Well, you did fly over to New York just to check out a job, so that's...
Yeah. That was 6 hours each way to watch three movies apiece.
Daniel Hyde, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Music director and organist of St. Thomas Fifth Avenue in New York City, Daniel Hyde. You can check out the season he is presenting with his St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys at their website, saint is spelled out, stthomaschurch.org/music/choir. And more specifically about my guest at his website, Daniel Hyde, H-Y-D-E, danielhyde.co.uk. I'll leave you with music of John Rutter. This is a prayer, God Be in My Head, performed by the St. Thomas Choir of Men and Boys, led by their music director and my guest today, Daniel Hyde. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.